And I can have a glass of water.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, good morning. And I just want to make a big shout out to the tech people. I know that from my own experience, I teach online, and I've been teaching with all the different mechanisms, and every 5 minutes they're coming out with something new that doesn't connect to something before it. So hopefully, what I wanted to have this morning are some really nice video parts of my presentation and all kinds of things like that to make it more interesting, but I may just have to talk, so you might just have to put up with me. So anyway, thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to be with you. I can't say that I've had much contact with your organization in any way other than through the Parliament of the World's Religions. I've been on the board for about 5 years with that. So anyway, so today, if you want to put up the first slide, I don't know how we're going to do this, but I've got an outline. It should be, these are just introductory pictures, and it seems, okay, stop. Right there. Okay, I want to start with a little bit of a personal story and then move into what I see as really important connections of different occasions throughout the last 100 years or so, maybe, beginning with the realization back in 1893 around the Chicago Expedition of the need for a Parliament of World Religions. And then coming from there, looking at the global ethic, which was developed by 1993, and then more recently in 2015, Pope Francis's encyclical on Laudato Si, on care for our common home. And then following that, the Parliament of World Religions came up with the fifth directive, which has to do with ecological concerns. And then most recently, this past October, fourth, in 2023, we have an apostolic exhortation coming from Pope Francis, and I'll hopefully explain some of those things. It's very simple, really. If we have time, and this is really where my own expertise moves into more of an academic thing, so we may not even want to go there. But I've done a fair amount of work with textual comparison of all of those texts. So, just to begin, if you'll put up the first slide, this is my little bit of a personal note. It was a quiet morning in May of in Windom, Minnesota, a small town in southwestern part of the state. Having finished planting our large garden, I sat with my mother on the back steps of our three-bedroom stucco house, sipping ice-cold lemonade. The newly planted garden was about a short distance away. The air was moist with the scent of the recently turned soil, seasoned with the wisps of the sweetness of the freshly mowed grass, and the piney scent from the tall spruce trees artfully placed on the yard. Through the lacy pine branches, the late evening sun signaled the day's impending end with shades of pinkish red-orange contrasting with gray shades of gray. A soft, high-pitched insect chorus lulled us to restful meditation. Then spontaneously harmonizing with the peace flow that came, there came my mother's words, "Only God can make the garden grow." Those faith-filled words stirred up something deep within me, but my 12-year-old self could not name it, so I just held them in silence for many years. Indeed, my adolescent persona required a certain kind of rebellion at being forced to help weed, tend, and harvest garden produce. Yet, secretly, I loved working in the garden. I was quite awestruck by the fact that you could put this hard, fat, flat, little yellow thing in the ground, and weeks later, you could find the sweet corn plant in its place. It was only some 30 years later that I would be able to name what had so deeply moved me that evening. Okay. Years later, on my 25th Jubilee as a Sister of St. Francis, I had the privilege of going on a pilgrimage to Assisi, Italy, the region of Umbria, the Franciscan Holy Land where St. Francis and St. Clare lived. As we journeyed from place to place, no one could miss the lush verdancy of the fertile fields of sunflowers, the vineyards covering the rolling hills. Those striking vistas, combined with St. Francis' Canticle of the Creatures, reawakened my many garden experiences and the profound sense of awe and wonder that I experienced that evening with my mother. Like me, but in their own time and place, St. Francis and St. Clair came to know what I had only tasted on that May evening, that the vestiges of the incarnate God was cradling them in love and mercy in the miraculous lush nest of creation. I lived in Chicago for about 30 years, but I had a real love-hate relationship with those environs. Everything is huge, impersonal, paved over, fast-paced, human-built, constantly in motion, competitive, and often violent. The saving grace was the park system and Lake Michigan. There, some semblance of intimacy with the web of life pervaded. People smiled and greeted one another, and Lake Michigan stretched out on the horizon, while the rhythm of the waves lap against the sands of extensive beaches, setting the tone of and pace for a more peaceful way of living. The manifestations of the sacred are there and are quite distinct from those found in the all large cavernous cathedrals that dot the street corners of that sprawling metropolis. Yes, St. Francis was definitely onto something. The vestiges of the incarnate God can be seen all around us if we only look and open our eyes to see. Now, the next part, I want to talk about some of the history. Just 130 years ago, in 1893, Chicago hosted the Columbian Expedition, a kind of world fair just a few miles southwest of our current location. And that's, when I say our location, I meant the school, which is in Hyde Park, not too far away from there. Charles Carroll Barney, a Chicago lawyer and member of the Swedenborgian Church, found the singular, secular, triumphalistic glorification of modernity's economics, science, and industry sorely inadequate to compensate for the loss of true religion's positive influence over the world affairs. Barney envisioned something nobler. Thus, he convened leading members of 45 religious and spiritual groups to form and achieve what he called, a spirit of understanding among the nations through religions. It was a huge success. They gathered daily over the course of the exposition. They agreed first that the world's religions must be brought together at the same time and place, stand side by side with equal rights, and communicate with respect for one another. And second, the Parliament of World Religions must be a movement of spontaneous encounter of ordinary persons of faith. It must counter the harmful effects of the arrogant 19th century Christianity. Following the failure of the Protestant Christian goal articulated in their 2010 Edinburgh conference, those believers shaken by World War I and threatened by World War II needed the Parliament of World Religions evermore. Globally, Christianity paled against Chinese traditionalism, Hinduism in India, Zionism, and Judaism in Israel and Islam in the Arab states. The postmodern world was clearly polycentric, ever-changing technologically, with nuclear war threatening total annihilation, environmental fears portending extinction, and the women's movement surging. Amid it all, the World Council of Churches was established in 1948 and Vatican Council II convened 1962 to 1965. Yet simultaneously, religious wars raged in Northern Ireland, Bosnia-Herzegovina, India, Sri Lanka, and the Middle East. The hazards of the religious polarization remain today, and the need for brotherhood, sisterhood of religions, the founding rationale for the 1893 Parliament of World Religions remains ever relevant. Now we move to 1993. Organizers of the 1993 Parliament of World Religions saw the need to strengthen the coexistence of religions, common convictions, values, and basic attitudes. They found the work of Swiss-born Catholic Tübingen University theologian Hans Küng concerning the New World ethic useful as the basis for engaging critical global problems. Kung asserted, quote, "There can be no peace in the world unless there is peace among the religions," unquote. Thus, Kung gathered with David G. Gomez Ibanez and Thomas Bema and drafted a document to guide the Parliament of World Religions work. Kung used the term ethic to signal a way of life, not a moral theory. After 2 years of consultation and revisions, and these were top laureate-style people that they consulted with, the global ethic was born, anchored by the global golden rule and with the mandate to, quote, treat all humans humanly. The language of the directives of the global ethic allows for its reformulation in terms meaningful to the various belief systems. Thus, the global ethic sustains a foundation for ongoing dialogue and positive common actions. At the 1993 Parliament in Chicago, the document toward a global ethic, an initial declaration, was adopted. And here I wish I had my video because it goes very briefly over some of the four principles that were there, nonviolence and respect for life, solidarity and a just economic order, third, tolerance and a life of truthfulness, and fourth, equal rights and partnership between men and women. Now we move ahead to 2015. And here we have on May 24th of 2015, Pope Francis published the encyclical Laudato Si on care for our common home. And again, I had a video that very quickly snapped through the top 10 teachings of all of it. You can hit the, if it'll come through.
Laudato Si. Here are the top 10 messages of the new encyclical. First, the big contribution of Laudato Si is an overview of the environmental crisis from a religious point of view. Until now, the dialogue about the environment was framed mainly with political, scientific, and economic language. Now, the language of faith decisively enters the discussion. Second, the disproportionate effect of environmental change on the poor is strongly highlighted in almost every page of the document, and the Pope provides many examples of the effects of climate change, whose worst impacts, he says, are felt by those in developing countries. Third, Pope Francis takes aim at the technocratic mindset, where technology is seen as the key to human existence. He critiques an unthinking reliance on market forces, in which every technological advancement is embraced before thinking about how it will affect our world. Christian spirituality, by contrast, offers a growth marked by moderation and the capacity to be happy with little. Fourth, against those who argue that a papal encyclical on the environment has no real authority, Pope Francis explicitly states that Laudato Si is now added to the body of the Church's social teaching. It continues reflection on modern-day problems that began with Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum on capital and labor in 1891. Fifth, discussions about ecology can be grounded in the Bible and church tradition. In chapter 2, Pope Francis introduces the gospel of creation, in which he leads readers to the call to care for creation that extends as far back as the book of Genesis, when humankind was called to till and keep the earth. But sadly, we have done too much tilling and not enough keeping. Sixth, everything is connected. Laudato Si is a systematic approach to the problem. First, the Pope links all of us to creation. We are part of nature, included in it, and thus in constant interaction with it. But our decisions have an inevitable effect on the environment. A blind pursuit of money that sets aside the interests of the marginalized and poor and the ruination of the planet are connected. Seventh, Pope Francis does not try to prove anything about climate change. Rather, his encyclical accepts the best scientific research available today and builds on it. So Laudato Si draws on both church teaching and contemporary scientific findings from all fields to help modern-day people reflect on important questions. Eight, Pope Francis critiques those who ignore the problems of climate change and especially its effect on the poor. Why are so many of the wealthy turning away from the poor? Not only because some view themselves as more worthy than others, but also because frequently decision makers are, for the most part, removed from the poor, with no real physical connection to their brothers and sisters. Selfishness also leads to the evaporation of the notion of the common good. Ninth, perhaps more than any encyclical, Pope Francis draws from the experiences of people from around the world, referring to the findings of bishops' conferences in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. The Pope calls into dialogue and debate all people about our common home. And finally, this encyclical is addressed to everyone on the planet and calls for a new way of looking at things. We face an urgent crisis when the earth has begun more and more to look like, in Pope Francis' vivid language, an immense pile of filth. Still, the doctrine is hopeful, reminding us that because God is with us, all of us can strive to change course. We can move towards an ecological conversion in which we can listen to the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. To use religious language, what the Pope is calling for is conversion.
Okay, you can move it to the next. Okay. Then, in following this, then, in 2019, the Parliament of the World Religions convened in Toronto, and at that point, there was an affirmation of the fifth directive. And so in the next video clip, now this is going to be a little longer. I think we're ahead of ourselves a little bit on time. So this is, the introduction is done by Rabbi Rosen. And then the different points of the fifth directive of the global ethic principle will be read by different representatives of different religious groups. So let's listen to that.
The several parliaments, we have evolved and adopted and discussed a global ethic which guides and shapes the commitments of the Parliament and perhaps guides others beyond the Parliament as well. But we came to the realization that it was perhaps incomplete. And that a fifth directive to the global ethic needed to address our relationship to our home, to our earth, and to each other. And to introduce that, Rabbi David Rosen, and then we will read the text. So, Rabbi Rosen.
Thank you, David. He introduced my predecessors coming from the Holy City. Allow me some one-upmanship. I come from the holier city. From the city of Jerusalem, it is home to Jews, Christians, Muslims, and so many more in the world. And I bring you the blessings of Jerusalem. It isn't that you heard my honor here simply to present, introduce the why and what we are addressing to the world from this particular gathering as the fifth directive of the global ethic. And you will be happy to know that that means that I'm the last speaker. While reference to environmental responsibility was contained within the global ethic that was promulgated, issued in the centenary celebration of the Parliament of the World Religions, we recognize today that there is a need for a separate commitment to a culture of sustainability and care for the environment. Our knowledge of the threat posed by climate change and by the degradation of the ecosystem means that to a large degree, all the wonderful things that we're trying to do in the world on so many other issues are like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic as we head for that massive iceberg. We can improve the quality of the lives of people on the Titanic. Yes, and there are plenty of things that we should care about for everybody. But we are in the face of a catastrophe, and that requires action like no other. As we have heard today, our behavior in the the world, and especially in the developed world, is reckless. And that recklessness will boomerang. We have heard of the terrible poverty in the world, and yet there is enough food in the world to feed the world. But the world is not being fed. And therefore we are here to say, literally, in every sense of the phrase, enough is enough. We have to strive for a responsible lifestyle. Last night I was talking about theological humility from this stage. Now we need to speak of the humility of lifestyle, modesty of lifestyle and of conduct. That is a demonstration of our responsibility and of our connectedness to not all of humanity, but as has been said, to the whole of the cosmos. Let me, before I introduce those who are going to present this fifth declaration, fifth directive, let me refer to an ancient Jewish midrash, probably 2,000 years ago, that talks of people in a boat. And the people are in a boat on the waters, and a man starts digging, drilling a hole underneath his seat. And the others say, what are you doing? He says, none of your business. This is my seat. I'm drilling under my seat. They say, but you drill under your seat. We will all drown. There is total interdependence in our world, and the actions of one reverberate upon the other, for worse and for better. Finally, let me also conclude with another midrash, well known to many here, that when God created the world, he took the first human being around for a guided tour of the Garden of Eden, and said, look at all these wonderful things that have been created for your pleasure and joy. Take heed that you do not destroy them, for if you do, there is no one left to repair. That is our challenge. May we be worthy of it. May this declaration, this directive that you are about to hear, go out to the world, so that we may save our planet, save our ship, save our home. Thank you.
Please welcome Sada Chanovich, Miriam Renault, Gopal Patel, Diane Dillon Ridgely, Andras Corbin Arthen, and please consider the fifth directive.
Dear sisters and brothers, Assalamu alaikum, Shalom aleichem, Shanti, greetings of peace. Part 1. Numberless men and women of all regions and religions strive to lead lives in a spirit of mutual harmony, interdependence, and respect for the earth, its living beings, and ecosystems. Nevertheless, in most parts of the world, pollution contaminates the soil, air, and water. Deforestation and over-reliance on fossil fuels contribute to climate change. Habitats are destroyed, and species are fished and hunted to extinction. Over-exploitation and unjust use of natural resources increases conflict and poverty among people and harms other forms of life. Too often, the poorest populations, though they have the smallest impact, bear the brunt of the damage done to the planet's atmosphere, land, and oceans.
The fifth directive continues. In the religious, spiritual, and cultural traditions of humankind, we find the directive, you shall not be greedy. Or in positive terms, remember the good of all. Let us reflect anew on the consequences of this directive. We should help provide, to the best of our ability, for the needs and well-being of others, including of today's and tomorrow's children. The earth, with its finite resources, is shared by our one human family. It sustains us in many forms of life and calls for our respect and care. Many religious, spiritual, and cultural traditions place us within the interdependent web of life. At the same time, they accord us a distinctive role and affirm that our gifts of knowledge and of craft place upon us the obligation to use these gifts wisely to foster the common good.
All of us have the responsibility to minimize as much as we can on our impact on the earth. To refrain from treating living beings and the environment as mere things for personal use and enjoyment, and to consider the effects of our actions on future generations. Caring and prudent use of resources is based on fairness in consumption and takes into account limits on what ecosystems can bear. Wherever heedless domination by human beings over the earth and other living beings is taught, wherever abuse of the environment is tolerated, and wherever development processes surpasses sustainable limits, we have the duty to speak up, to change our practices, and to moderate our lifestyles.
Hello. Part 4 is addressed to young people. You may notice that I'm no longer physically young, but I'm young in spirit and heart. And as the mother of Karima Afia and Dasal Naji, I will say, young people should be encouraged to appreciate that a good life is not a life of outsized consumption or amassing material possessions. A good life strikes a balance between one's needs, the needs of others, and the health of the planet. Education about the environment and sustainable living should become part of the school curriculum in every country of the world.
To be authentically human in the spirit of our religious, spiritual, and cultural traditions means the following. Our relationship with each other and with the larger living world should be based on respect, care, and gratitude. All traditions teach that the earth is a source of wonder and wisdom. Its vitality, diversity, and beauty are held in trust for everyone, including those who will come after us. The global environmental crisis is urgent and it is deepening. The planet and its countless forms of life are in danger. Time is running out. We must act with love and compassion, and for justice and fairness, for the flourishing of the whole Earth community.
Okay, so you've just heard the fifth directive, and then that took place in 2019. And so in just this last October, we received from Pope Francis what you see on the screen there, that listing is again another way in which this ethic, as it comes through in the global ethic, is set in language such that each tradition can elaborate as it needs to make it more specific to their constituencies. And so then after about 6 years now, we've got In 2023, this past October, we have from Pope Francis what is known in, within Catholicism as an apostolic exhortation. And this is a document that focuses on a single issue, usually of justice or morality. And so this is really a follow-up to Laudato Si, the wider document that you heard about in the video. And here we just have a real focus on climate change. So you want to do that, advance it, and then there should be another video.
Is this the one you want?
That's it, right there, yeah.
To the powerful, I ask, why do you want to preserve power that will be remembered for its inability to stop the climate crisis when it was urgent and necessary? Today, a single generation can experience the acceleration of global warming. We're not talking about centuries or millennia, but just a few years. We do not have to look far to find the cause. It is us. How are we going to take care of our common home if we conform to the logic of maximum profit at the lowest cost? This logic gives power to a few and contributes to the fact that the most disadvantaged suffer especially the consequences of climate change. In Laudato Si, Pope Francis already addressed the consequences of the process of environmental degradation. Over these 8 years, the planet has continued to suffer from our attacks. Behind this lack of an effective response, there is a technocratic paradigm that starts from the idea that human beings can expand without any limits their power thanks to technology. If we do not break out of this technocratic paradigm, we will isolate ourselves from the world around us, in which God has united us all. To change this trend, multilateral agreements among states are essential. It is necessary that world organizations have a real authority to ensure that the objectives set out in them are achieved. This has not been the case up to now, because the damage to the planet has already been done, but we still have time to prevent it from becoming greater.
It'll go. It'll go.
The COP28 of the United Nations to be held in Dubai must be a turning point. This conference must produce agreements for the energy transition that are efficient, binding, and easy to monitor. Let us act. Let us accept the invitation of Pope Francis to walk together on a path of reconciliation with the world in which we live and unify it with the contribution of each one of us. This message, which the Pope has entitled Praise God, reminds us that human beings who pretend to take the place of God become the worst danger to themselves.
Okay. Now, if we had more time, I would be real happy to compare some of these documents, because they all have different purposes and they all have a little bit different, more of the commentary that probably can makes up the totality of what needs to be said. But I think what we'll do at this point, if you want to, I don't know if those pictures are going to come up at all on there. We seem to have a slow connection, so I think it might be more difficult to do the next section. But what I basically want to say is that there is remarkable consistency in the various religious documents that have been produced around the world. I've had the privilege to sit at many of those tables. I'm going to be going in March to Assisi, where there's going to be the major Christian denominations are going to be coming together and trying to more formally within each of the major traditions, Christian traditions, to insert into the liturgical calendar more emphasis on the doctrine of creation. So it's a forthcoming thing, and along with that, there's tremendous more activity. But you'll notice that on the one hand, you've got the global ethic, which is an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that articulates the major points. And then you've got the 200-page encyclical that comes from Rome and really delves deeply into Catholic doctrine and all the different categories of theology and so on. And then, you have to understand with the Laudato Si, that reaches way back to the early times of apostolic Christianity, the first centuries after the life and ministry of Jesus. We had different communities spread all over the known world at that time, and the way they kept in touch with each other was that they circulated letters, and that different from the Pony Express in this country. And so when you look at Laudato Si, that has, within the Catholic community, the highest authority in terms of what it has to say. Now, does that mean that every Catholic stands under the whipping post and says, you know, by virtue of conscience, you must confirm? No, because that would be a major violation of everything that Catholicism teaches about how to form one's moral conscience. The conscience is ultimately free, but if one, in fact, claims to be a Christian and conform to the understanding of what Jesus is trying to tell me in my life today, if that's my profound commitment, then I got to work like crazy to understand what's going on in Laudato Si and do the best I can to fulfill whatever it says in my particular station in life at this moment in history. Because that's the compliance. It's the desire to do the good in the deepest sense and to use what I have to make that principle happen, whatever it is. The basic formula is, you know, if I am aware of something that is not good or an evil even, then I must strive to do something about it. And if I recognize that I can do something about it and I do not do that, I am sinning. That's the definition of sin. It's not that you stand being clumped over the head and you must do just this one thing. So that's something I want to be clear about of what an encyclical has to say. The apostolic exhortation focuses in on, as you heard here, the fact that we've been trying to act, but we sure haven't done enough. And we sure have a lot more to go. And if we really value this, then somehow that's going to get kicked up to a priority, in not just in what maybe how we vote or something like that, but we personally, individually, now here, are going to make some sincere, definite changes in our life. This trip to Winona is the first time that I've driven my car in about 3 months. Fossil fuels. We knew about that, you know, almost 100 years ago when we started digging it out of soil. So it's that kind of thing. So that's just some clarification. And then, you know, textually, I mean, I've gone through, you know, word by word, quite literally, with all these documents, and I teach graduate students, so they have to know some of that stuff. So, but anyway, I think probably right now it might be enough to simply say that within those six chapters, you know, we have, this is of Laudato Si, we have those kind of basic points, and just to rehearse that again real quickly, that in chapter one, we're looking at the state of the earth. In chapter two, we're looking both at Old and New Testament texts and Christian doctrines around what is kind of at the core of what we say we believe about that. In the third chapter, that's where he starts doing this more the social, political, economic analysis and talks about the technocracy and the excessive self-centeredness of people. Chapter four, he emphasizes the integral ecology, how everything is connected. And then chapter five is really a call for honest dialogue. And he's really big on dialogue. And it's not just a conversation. It's organized, facilitated, principled kind of going back and forth with, until we find common ground. You might have heard in the news about the Synod. It's that kind of a deep kind of process that we're engaging in on a lot of these things. And then the final chapter really has a couple of different prayers, those that believe in God, and then one that is for specifically for Christians. And then with the nine themes that come through, again, it's simply look, and these are spun in and out of all the different chapters and parts of the document, where we have the emphasis on the poor and the fragility of the planet, the interconnectedness of the world, different paradigms of power that seem to work better than others, in the economic progress, the valuing of each creature. You know, so many times we are discarding half of the animal world. We're already losing most of that anyway. But to really see how it's worth protecting grasshoppers, for example, they have a function, and that we have this sense of debate and responsibility, and both international and local, and then finally a new whole new lifestyle, and the intervention of and the invitation to interreligious dialogue is major, and that happened actually spontaneously right after the encyclical was let go. So maybe we'll just pause here, and then if you get any kind of questions or comments, I know it's a lot, but there's a lot here.
I think in the interest of time, we will leave our questions to the board.
Thank you. Yep.